The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Hey, well, it's nice to be here again, and thank you again for providing Scottish summer weather. Really appreciate the fact I had to put a jacket on today. So I think I must be becoming acclimatised. My children at home told me it was -8 last night, which is quite unusual. So I'm babbling and brave, I put this, because I think this is just a fantastic passage in different ways. Let's just say something about Paul's observation. He walked around and looked carefully. Now, let's see if I can... This is where he was. That's not Paul, by the way. It's what he would have looked like, of course. But that is Mars Hill. It's the Areopagus in the back. And Paul has walked around this gorgeous city. Athens was a lovely city. And what he did was... He observed, he looked. This is just a scale model of the Parthenon, and that's what he's looking at. That's up in the back there, and it's in the context of what he is referring to. There's another idea that you can see what it would look like, and probably from around where he was speaking. We'll come back to that other one in a minute. That's the other Parthenon. Let's just leave it at that one just now. Now, the thing about Athens was, it had once been the intellectual centre of the ancient world, but was now in a period of decline. It was a free city and it had a famous university, but it tended to live on its reputation. When Paul arrived, he was not so much impressed by the culture as irritated by the evidences of idolatry. And what I want to do in this is to draw direct parallels where we're at in the culture today. I had the advantage of being out in Pitt Town earlier this morning at a meeting and driving out west. And it's interesting for me about Sydney how there are so many different parts and different people belong to different parts. You know, I do feel like I'm becoming a bit of a Sydney snob, because I feel that when I cross the bridge into North Shore, I'm entering civilization. And I feel when I head down to the Shire, I'm entering Hobbit Land. If I head out west, I can't help but think of the Wild West. I feel that I'm entering Mississippi, and so on. There are numerous different places and different areas. But people have images of a city. And I often wonder what people's image of Sydney is. So my folks in Scotland think, you've come out to paradise. And I tell them that paradise is burning, and they don't quite believe that. But I'm thinking more of if you walk around, if you observe and you see things. So I mean, I do like doing that. My wife and I are dreadful when we go to a restaurant. People must think our marriage is really bad because we hardly talk to each other. We basically sit and look at everybody else, and sometimes we work out their stories and we tell each other, oh, see that couple there. So if you come to a restaurant with us and you think we're talking about you, we probably are. And we're just going on your looks and various other things, you know. But just observing things about people. And I love walking around the city. So Simon Manchester took us out last Saturday, and he's a local boy, Sydney born and bred. And so he took us down the markets and then along City Quay and up various alleys. And it's just, he points out things that you don't notice. Sometimes you can live in a city for a long time and it takes a stranger to come and see things. So I always like observing and looking around and seeing different things. And if you were to walk around Sydney, I wonder what you would think of this city. You might think it's an opera-loving city, you know, because there we have, you know, that's right at the centre. Everyone knows about this, don't they? I'm really struggling to meet Sydney people who like opera. I love opera, and I love cricket, and I'm a Scotsman, and they think I'm a freak. I'm just really, really weird, but I do love opera. But people might think that. They might think, it's to do with this, coffee. You know, there's coffee everywhere. I work in the CBD, obviously, and you go down all these wee side streets, and there's all these wee coffee shops, and people are like very proud of their coffee. Somebody actually just sent me a text: best coffee in Newtown. I don't want to start an argument. I'm staying out of that one. I think I told you last week I went to Melbourne and joked about coming back to the capital and to get a decent cup of coffee. Well, I'm not going to be invited back to Melbourne. People take coffee very seriously. It's just a drink. Never mind. What about boutique shops? You walk around and you see people queuing up to get into these boutique shops. You know, the really expensive ones where some of you I see have never been there. Others of you I suspect may have been. The ones that you kind of almost have to sign in. You only get let in groups. They search you on the way out. Why do people pay for that kind of, you know, who's going to pay a couple of $1,000 for a handbag when they've already got 10? Apparently some people do. So maybe this is a very materialistic city. Sport is a huge, huge issue. Another thing that Paul would have seen in Athens was he would have seen a lot, and he did see a lot of these religious places of worship. Now, there are fine buildings, there are fine religious buildings. If we were back in Scotland, you would, in every town, in every city, you would see these great churches. Trouble is, most of them are empty. Are the people very religious? Probably not. So I think that you can walk around the city, you can observe, and you can learn. But if I was making an observation about Sydney, and please do not take this personally if you're a Sydneysider, because I would make it, it's far worse in my own country, I would make it in general about most Western cities, that we're like Athens was. We're living off the past and the glories of the past. We're largely dumbed down compared to what we were. And a lot of our culture, if you like, is borrowed culture, as culture often is. I think we're confused and I think we're immoral. And the simple way to justify that is if you and I went out from here and picked up a Sydney Morning Herald and looked through the issues, we would see the idolatry, we would see the confusion, we would see a lot of the mess. I haven't watched it yet, but in the United Kingdom there was a debate between Boris Johnson and Jeremy Corbyn for the election. I can tell you straight away, it would have been dumbed down, it would have been very confusing, and people would have got very frustrated. There's a sense in which sometimes it feels as though the West is in decline. It's not true everywhere. It may not even be true of Sydney. But my friends in Melbourne tell me it is. Here's the second thing. He observed and he reasoned. Now, there were two groups of people that he was particularly concerned about. One was the Epicureans. It says there he reasoned with the Epicureans. Epicurus, 341 to 270 BC, he taught that one should pursue fulfillment and actively avoid displeasure. And basically, materialism and pleasure meant there was little room for God. I think these two philosophies, by the way, are very predominant in this city. So materialism and pleasure. A lot of people, why are they working? Are they working for the joy of their job? Some are. But you're also working to get money, and you're working to get money to buy material things, and you're never satisfied. You know, you've got an apartment in town, so no, you want a bigger one or a home in, I don't know, Artarmon, where we are. It's not good enough. You want to be in Kirribilli. You know, the people are always looking to add more and to get more, queuing outside the boutique shops to get more things. That is very much part of the philosophy of our society. But the Stoics, founder, not Stoic, but Zeno, 340 to 265 BC, they had a different attitude. They thought that you attain fulfillment by a kind of Zen-like calm, almost like Buddhism, that you accepted the course of events, including pain and suffering. And there was a kind of impersonal divine necessity or fate. They were basically, que sera, sera, whatever will be, will be. They stressed the importance of reason as the principle which was inherent in the structure of the universe by which people ought to live. They had this pantheistic view of God as of the world soul, and they were very strong on things like ethics of obedience and self-sufficiency. And again, they had very little room for God. And I think that is something that's deeply ingrained in our culture as well. In fact, I do wonder if culturally we're not in a progressive society, we're in a regressive society going back to this Greco-Roman view of the world. So you'll find people generally pantheistic, that kind of we're into the spiritual and the oneness of everything. Or you'll find that people say, well, we do everything by reason, although I find that often people who say they go by reason and evidence don't show any reason or offer any evidence. It's a belief. And you'll find, for example, if I went into the street just now and spoke to a lot of people, do you believe in God? No, because it's unreasonable. Have you ever thought about it? No. Do you know any of the reasons? No. That doesn't matter. So I've been engaged in a wee Twitter debate sparked by Peter Fitzsimons, who's one of your more tolerant atheists. And dear Peter, you know, he knew he was letting loose his hounds of war upon me, but he didn't realise I was Scottish, so I just kept going. And I think I've worn them all down. I think they've all given up now. But their big argument was, there is no evidence. Now, what do you say? If you're not a Christian, and you're saying, I want evidence, this is the one question I have for anyone who says that. And it's simply this. What evidence would you accept that you would regard as proof of God? And that's the question you should have. Because I'll tell you what, with the kind of atheist fundamentalists like Peter Fitzsimons, when they ask for evidence, they're not asking. They're telling you there is no evidence. And anything you offer as evidence, they will say it's not evidence. Because they don't believe there can be any evidence for God. So I asked someone, you know, tell me. And they, none of them, any evidence you've got. I said, no. I'm not going to waste my time with you unless you tell me what you would accept. And eventually one of them came up with, okay, something that is scientifically testifiable and repeatable. And I said, okay, like Caesar's Wars. They didn't happen because they're not repeatable. And he went, okay, no. So you don't believe in anything unless you can scientifically prove it. And that's a real, real problem. And I think that's the kind of almost stoical attitude. Now, Paul, when he debated, it didn't work. Why? They considered he was a babbler. That's the term they use. Basically, you're someone going around collecting scraps. You're like one of the homeless people sleeping across in the park, and they're going around gathering the remains out of bins. That's what they called him. Or advocating foreign gods. Why is that important? Well, you've all heard of Socrates. Socrates in Athens was executed 450 years earlier. Still remember, why was he executed? He was executed for advocating foreign gods. So it was a very dangerous accusation for Paul to face. I was thinking what the equivalent is today, and it's a bit like if you're standing to be a politician. This is certainly true in the United Kingdom. I don't know if it's true here. But if you ever said anything against Islam, you're done. There's three candidates who had to withdraw from the Labour and the Conservative Party in their elections because they've suggested that not everything about Islam is necessarily good. And it's quite remarkable that that's considered to be almost a crime. I saw an interview with a policeman recently who was explaining why they'd arrest someone, and he explained to this man who was a street preacher, and he said, we want to investigate your thought. So we're getting on not just hate speech, but now we're getting on to hate thought. And I think there's something in the poll saying, what you are saying is so outrageous that it goes against the basic values of our society. Now, Paul says, look what all the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. I don't know if any of you watch TED Talks, but I'll watch and see if I've got. There's a TED Talk. Look what it says. Ideas worth spreading. And then the subtext of it is thousands and thousands of ideas. New ideas every day. I quite like sitting talking about ideas, so I have a certain empathy with these guys. But it seems like, again, in our culture, in our society, there's an awful lot of talk. And sometimes very little action. I think Luke is being sarcastic here, actually. He's saying they just want to be stimulated by new ideas, but they don't get anywhere. And that's why he goes on to say this, that Paul proclaimed, he stood up in the meeting of Athens, and he proclaimed. And it was remarkably brave what he said. He speaks about an unknown God. He's not saying, here's this unknown God, and you're right to worship him or her on this statue. He's not saying that. He's saying you're ignorant. You don't know what you're talking about. He's also remarkably brave. I mean, this is like standing in Mecca and saying, nah, it doesn't work. Sorry, Muhammad didn't do this. No, he's not going to live long. What Paul does is he stands with the Parthenon costing, in today's term, billions that these people had invested in, and he said, you've wasted your money. That's what that means. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth. He doesn't live in temples. He doesn't live there. You guys have wasted your money. And that's challenging people's idols. And that gets really, really upsetting for a lot of people. I've often thought, and maybe this is just a self-justification, that if a preacher doesn't upset someone, he's not really preaching. Maybe that's self-justification because I have a unique ability to upset people. So there's possibly even psychoanalyze that if you wish. But I do think that what happens is God gets under the surface and begins to challenge and question us at our most deepest values and at the deepest level. So Paul proclaims, for Luke, the word he uses here, it's kind of like, you could say it's argument. Socrates did argue. Socrates would argue with anybody. And again, I have a lot of empathy with Socrates because that's my modus operandi of working. I never grew out of it as a child. Why is that? That's not right. That's wrong. And you learn by questioning. And that's what Socrates did. That's the Socratic method. You ask a question, you ask a question, you ask a question. Because you want to find out. But Luke here means, it almost means preach rather than debate. Paul says, I'm going to proclaim to you, I'm going to tell you about Jesus. Well, let me just think about it in this way. Let me come and apply this back to this city. I'll go on to the next one. This, I just think this is amazing. This is the Sydney coat of arms and Sydney's motto. I take, but I surrender. And I'm still trying to work out how that's an inspiring motto. This, I want to go back to, this is Glasgow in Scotland's coat of arms. And it has the phrase, let Glasgow flourish. And if you went there, you'd see that on all the banners and so on. But what they never put is the remainder of the original motto, which was, by the preaching of your word and the praising of your name. How will the city flourish? I believe that I missed it, I intended to go, but the Sydney Morning Herald had a whole day symposium on the future of Sydney and the flourishing of Sydney. What are they going to talk about? Providing water. Where do we expand to? What about the economy? What about jobs? What about culture? Should the CBD be opened up more for raves at night? Because it's a bit dead, apparently, compared with Melbourne, depending on what you think. You know, and all these kinds of issues, I will 100% guarantee that, and I wish I'd been there because I would have asked, that nobody said Sydney will flourish by the preaching of your word. And yet I believe that that is the truth. I'll just give you one story to finish and you can then put in your questions. For reasons which I won't go into, I was asked to write an article in the gay magazine in Scotland. So I said to the editor, are you sure? You really want me to write about what the church says about homosexuality and so on? And he said, yeah, I do, David, because we've really had a go at you and present your own case. So I did. It remains to this day their most read article ever and their most commented on. Some of the mail I got was extremely interesting. But people were having a real go at me and at him. And a gay rights activist wrote into the newspaper and said, listen, guys, you need to leave David Robertson alone. I would rather live in a Scotland where his Christianity was predominant than in any other. And I thought, wow, so I started corresponding with him. And he said, look, David, you and I disagree about this issue, but he said, I still think I really like the view of Christianity that you present and all that kind of stuff. And then he said, look, all I'm asking is this. I want to live in a city like, and he listed 10 cities. He actually listed 10 countries. That's all I'm asking. And I wrote back to him and said, do you think this is coincidence? But every single one of those places you have mentioned have had what we call an evangelical revival. Maybe, just maybe, It's the preaching of God's word and the response to it that causes prosperity. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's the lesson today. I'll leave that there. The article, it was called Kaleidoscope, was the magazine, and they had written an article about me, saying Free Church takes lurch to right with appointment of homophobic moderator. So in Free Church terms, I was on the left wing, you know. So it was quite strange. So I wrote to the editor and said, look, fair enough, you can write what you want about me, I don't care. It's a free company, but you should at least ask me what my views were, and that's how he asked me to write. So it was, what does the Bible or what does the church teach about homosexuality? If you email me, I can send you a copy of it. Because it's kind of one of these issues that, I'll go and do a talk on science and God, and about the first or second question I get will be that question.
Yeah.
Which I always think, why? You know, so I've got so used to answering it now.
What's your answer in 30 seconds?
My answer is, first of all, when people ask you a question, you need to work out whether they're making an accusation or asking. So if someone's saying, what do you think about homosexuality? Because my kid brother committed suicide because he was gay. That's a very different question from, why are you such a homophobic bigot? Which is normally what's being asked. And if someone asks me that, in that sense, and I'm aware of that, I would say, first of all, you must... I'll give you my very brief... My five-point thing is, number one, I think all forms of homophobia are wrong. So for a Christian to be afraid of any other group is just daft, and that's what homophobia means. So I think that's just wrong. Number two, I'm an IKEA Christian. What do I mean by that? When I make furniture, I can't make furniture. I'm totally useless. So if we go to IKEA, I'm the guy who unpacks it and counts all the screws and follow the instructions to the letter. I believe God made human beings, obey the main instructions. Number three, God created us as sexual beings, but he created sex as special, not dirty, and sacred, and to be within the context of marriage, and marriage is between a God, marriage between a man and a woman. Number four, humanity has fallen, we're messed up all over the place, we're all messed up, and personally, I don't make a distinction between heterosexual or homosexual. And number five, don't you dare call me a homophobic bigot just because I uphold the standards that have made Western society for the past 1,500 years, until at least you've got something that works properly the other way. Because my argument is the current sexual philosophy is not working. It's creating mass confusion, destroying families, and I'm not particularly talking about homosexuality. I'm just talking about the attitude to sex and sexuality in general. So it's such a cliche, I know, but in my church back in Scotland, I had several people who were gay. You know, people would come up, they'd be, this is what we do. Sorry, it's such a long answer. Sometimes someone, I think they're testing you, go, hi, I'm James, and I'm gay. And I would go, hi, and I'm David. I guess we're never going to get it on. What? Why did you tell me that? I don't care if you're gay. What? In other words, taking sexuality as an identity is a strange thing. You know, I personally think taking race as your primary identity is a strange thing. Or taking your social status. For a Christian, our identity is found in Christ. But for me, I look at every single human being, and whatever their sexuality, race, whatever, and say they're human. So, sorry, that was the gist of where we were going. Anyone else want to add anything or say anything about anything else? I promise not to give such a long answer.
No, that was a very good question. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Now you can speak again. I mean, do you recognize this kind of, how weird you are if you're saying, actually, by the preaching of the word, it's how God blesses a city. Oh, come on. People think you're crazy. But it just works. I mean, I find that in teaching the Bible, and I'll say this just to finish, I find in teaching the Bible, I went to a church where there was virtually nobody. Well, there's seven people, four of them left. Because that's the impact you have initially on people. I have initially on people. Get through the stitch stage, you'll be okay. And yet, as I was teaching the Bible, people came in from all different backgrounds. And they came because they wanted to hear something real, something that applied to their life, something that was deep. And I think that's what the Bible does. I've been teaching it for 35 years, and I'm learning pretty well something new, certainly every week, and sometimes almost every day.
And that's the wonderful thing about it. And that's the good thing, by the way, about Bible shorts. We're just giving you a wee short. I'll finish with this. There's a man came into a service. I was preaching on Job. And he'd never been. He came with a whole bunch of his family. And he came because I buried his mother. And going out, he said, "Man, you, this is that. That was amazing." I said, "Oh, thank you." He says, "No, no, no," he says, "you preach a whole year's worth of sermons in one go just because I don't come to church." And I said, "No, no, no. No, no." I said, "Honestly, I normally speak for 40 minutes. And he said, "Man, I didn't realize there was so much in the Bible." And I said to him, "Yeah, that's only one chapter. I've got hundreds more. Will you be back?" And he went, "Nah." But I kept in touch with him and different things, you know. And that's what I'm saying. There's so much in it. And if you're a Christian, be encouraged by that. And if you're not a Christian, get reading.
David? The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.